Okay, well, good afternoon. My name is Richard Clem. Today is November 25th, 2019, and we are covering the ethics rules as adopted in Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota, and many other states as well, because most states have adopted the Model Code of Professional Responsibility. And that's the topic of today's program. We're doing it as a live conference call program today, and also we're recording the call for the podcast. So if you're a podcast listener, if you're listening to the on-demand version of the program, during the program I will give a number of code numbers for you to write down. So write those down when you hear them and email them to me at the conclusion of the program so that I can record your attendance. If you're driving, don't try to write them down. And if you miss one of them or something, I'm not heartless. So if something happens and you just didn't hear one of the numbers, just explain what happened and how long you were on the line. But that's how we take attendance for the on-demand programs. And you can email those to clem.law@usa.net. So again, the program today is entitled Ethics Refresher, and we're just covering the Model Code of Professional Responsibility, and we're pretty much just going to be plodding through the actual text of the rules. So the first thing I often tell attorneys who are taking the program is that, well, unfortunately, you're not really going to get your money's worth out of today's program. And the reason why I say that is that there is a very limited practical value of simply sitting down and hearing what the rules have to say. Rule 1.6 says I'm supposed to do this. Because the actual text of the rule, in many cases, does not give you a whole lot of practical guidance on how to deal with the actual difficult situations that come up in the practice of law. Because more often than not, when you do have some ethical dilemma, one rule says that you're supposed to do one thing, and another rule seemingly says that you're supposed to do the exact opposite. So it's usually a lot more difficult, and you usually can't get a whole lot of clarity just by looking at the rules and expecting them to tell you exactly what to do. So like I say, for that reason, you will not get your money's worth out of today's program. Now, when I say that, of course, I have to worry that attorneys will start clamoring for a refund. But please hold off doing that just momentarily, because you actually will get your money's worth in a couple of ways. One of them is that you will actually get CLE credit for the program. And believe it or not, most of the attorneys who take this program are taking it for the CLE credit. Today's live program has been approved in Wisconsin and Iowa. I expect the podcast version of the program to be approved in those states, probably also Minnesota. So you will get your CLE credit. And like I say, that's the reason most attorneys take the program. But the other surprising thing that you might learn is, well, you might actually get something out of the program. There might be some certain amount of practical value. And the reason for that is that even though you can't resolve those difficult problems that come up on a day-to-day basis by simply looking at the rules, well, obviously the rules are the starting point. So if you have a conflict of interest, you're probably going to have to dig kind of deeply and think about it quite a bit. But obviously the starting point is going to be, in that case, Rule 1.7, that tells you that you're not supposed to engage in conflicts of interest. So there is a certain amount of practical value that way, because at least you get the starting point. You know what questions to ask. You know what you don't know. And then also there are a certain number of very specific provisions. So, for example, when we talk about the trust account rules, they vary a little bit from state to state, but they're very, very specific provisions that you have to do exactly what the rule tells you. So in that case, you will get your money's worth out of the program. And I try to, and even though, like I say, we're just going to be plodding through the text from cover to cover, I'll try to make the program as interesting as possible. given the constraints of the subject matter of the program. And then today's program, which actually some of the callers are not going to be listening to the full program, we'll have a fourth hour on that topic of conflicts of interest, because that's an area where it is possible or where it's necessary to go into a little bit more detail rather than what the actual text of the rule has to say. So you will hear that in hour number four of the podcast. So anyway, with that little introduction, I will just also point out though that if you want to know when those difficult situations come up, when you have one of those ethical dilemmas, when you don't really know exactly what you're supposed to be doing, my main piece of advice in those situations is seek the advice of another attorney. So when you have some difficult problem come up, talk to a colleague, talk to the attorney down the hall, talk to your friend who's an attorney, or give me a call and ask me what I think. Now, I say that not because I'm any smarter than you are or I'm any more ethical than you are. But the reason why get that outside view is I've read a lot in the course of putting together CLE programs. I read a lot of Supreme Court decisions from various states, and unfortunately, the very large number of the Supreme Court decisions of most state Supreme Courts involve ethics complaints and attorneys who got themselves into trouble. And more often than not, when I see those cases, I think to myself, boy, this attorney sure could have saved a lot of trouble if early on in the process they would have talked to a colleague and say, what do you think I should do in this situation? Because what often happens is the attorney will make some kind of small mistake that usually is not too big of a deal, but it kind of seems like a big deal to them, and they keep digging themselves in deeper and deeper and deeper. More often than not, if they would have talked to some colleague, the colleague would have said, you can solve that problem just by doing this. There's usually an easy solution early on, a lot of attorneys have a tendency to want to go it alone, and they wind up just digging themselves in deeper and deeper. So you don't want that to happen to you. So when those ethical dilemmas come up, when you have questions, when you don't know what to do, seek advice of some attorney. Those of you who are Wisconsin attorneys, you have an excellent resource at your disposal that I've heard nothing but good things about, and that is your state bar association, which you're required to be a member of. You have to pay the dues, whether you want to or not. Well, you may as well take advantage of the service they offer, their ethics hotline. When you do have those problems, just call up that State Bar Association Ethics Hotline. And like I say, all the attorneys I've talked to have taken advantage of that, said it is really a good service, including some attorneys. I had one attorney, he was admitted in both Illinois and Wisconsin. And his practice is, in Illinois. He doesn't have an office in Wisconsin. He doesn't really have too many Wisconsin cases. But when he has ethical questions, he calls the Wisconsin Ethics Hotline because it's so much better than the Illinois one, he told me. So you as Wisconsin attorneys have that really good resource. I know one resource I have available is a Minnesota attorney, and this is probably true in most other states as well. I can call up the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility, tell them I'm an attorney, and say I want an advisory opinion about what I should do in the following situation. And as long as I fully disclose all of the relevant facts and I follow their advice, I'm pretty well protected. Theoretically, they could change their mind. So I call up and say, what should I do? And they tell me to do something, and then I get disbarred for doing that because they changed their mind. But even though that's theoretically possible, it's never happened. So keep that in mind for the really difficult situations. Call up your state regulator and just ask. Although that's kind of a last resort, because once you call up and ask for their advice, well, you're kind of stuck taking it. So even if you later come up with a better solution, I would be kind of hesitant to use the better solution once somebody officially told you what the solution was. But that's a resource you should always keep in mind. Finally, if you're so interested in the subject of professional responsibility and legal ethics that you want to read more about the topic after today's program, I recommend the book Minnesota Legal Ethics by William Wernz. And even though the title is Minnesota Legal Ethics, it really applies to attorneys just about anywhere because they're following the same rules of professional conduct. The reason I recommend that book is for two reasons. One is it's actually a pretty interesting book given the subject matter. Because William Wernz was for many years the head of the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility in Minnesota. So the book is full of all kinds of interesting war stories about all of the dishonest attorneys he encountered in the state of Minnesota over the years. So it's kind of interesting reading about all the bad things these Minnesota lawyers did over the years. I'm sure Wisconsin and Iowa attorneys wouldn't do things quite that bad. But you can check that out. And then the other reason why I recommend that book is, because it's free. It's available from the Minnesota State Bar Association, and in the course materials I have a link to it. And you don't have to be a member or anything, but it's available for free download. So like I say, that's my book recommendation for the day, Minnesota Legal Ethics by William Wernz. Anyway, with that introduction, we will just delve right into the rules. The rules are numbered, and the first rule is 1.0. Rule 1.0 is simply a list of definitions. So we're not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about that because most of the words that are defined in the rules have... the definition is, pretty much matches the ordinary everyday definition that you would find in the dictionary. So there's not a lot that's particularly profound there. With the possible exceptions of the words writing and the word signature, the word writing includes, ink stains that are dried upon a line, traditional, hard copy dead tree documents. Those are certainly writings. Electronic documents are certainly writings. But also things that you might not think of as writing are actually writings for purposes of the rules. So, for example, a voice recording. Today's podcast, for example, is a writing. So if I'm required to do something in writing, if I said it right now, that's saying it in writing. Because anything that's kind of preserved in permanent form is a writing. And similarly, a signature could be, anything that indicates that the party is assenting to a particular document. So it could be, a voice recording, or something like that. That might be stretching it a little bit, but keep in mind that those definitions are pretty broad. So if the rules say that you're supposed to do something in writing, well, you probably ought to do it in writing, make a document or at least an electronic document. But if you ever get yourself in trouble, say, you forgot to put in writing that, this thing that you're supposed to put in writing, but then it suddenly dawns on you that, I left a voicemail for the person. Well, that voicemail could very well constitute a writing for purposes of this rule. So keep in mind, if you ever do have issues construing the rules, that there are a list of definitions. So the rule says you have to do something for a client. Well, you probably know what a client is, but if there's any ambiguity, perhaps looking at the rule and the definition of client might clear up that ambiguity. Well, the first substantive rule, after we get through the list of definitions, is Rule 1.1. This is definitely a rule where you're not going to get your money's worth today, because I'm going to do little more than read to you what Rule 1.1 has to say. Rule 1.1 just says that when you're representing a client, you're supposed to do it competently. A lawyer shall provide competent representation to a client. But unfortunately, it doesn't really define the word competent other than to say it requires the legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation that are reasonably necessary. So in other words, in judging competence. It's what, well, it's probably what the late Justice Stewart would define it as, well, I'll know it when I see it. Kind of hard to pin down the definition of that. So like I say, not learning anything that you didn't know already when we cover Rule 1.1. But just keep in mind that one of our professional obligations is, well, we're supposed to be competent when we represent our clients. There's a comment following that rule that points out that, well, there's always a first time for everything. So if I go in for my brain surgery and the brain surgeon is new on the job, you know, he's starting on his first brain surgery. Well, he has to start somewhere, so he can still very well be competent, assuming, of course, that he's made reasonable preparation. Similarly, as an attorney, you know, if I, well, you know, I don't do a whole lot of probate. But I had a probate case that I had to file this morning, you know, the attorney who does probate every single day, they probably knew everything, but I had to, you know, have my little checklist of exactly what I had to do. So I'm confident I did it competently, even though it's not something I do on a routine basis. Rule 1.1, the comment makes that clear. So anyway, that's the first rule, 1.1. The next rule, though, Rule 1.2, we will spend a little bit more time on, and hopefully we'll get some money's worth. I just heard another caller getting on the line there. Is that Julia?
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us. We started a little bit early. Because you're just here for 1 hour, and the other caller will be here longer, and I actually have to run, and she was available early, so it worked out well to start a little bit early. We just kind of went over I'll recap the introduction, the introduction was, today we're just going through the rules of professional conduct kind of in their entirety.
Sure.
for the next 50 minutes, if you're in Wisconsin, or the next hour, we will be covering some of the text of those rules, very much just an overview of what the rules have to say, without getting into a lot of specifics. We just covered Rule 1.0, which is just a list of definitions, and then Rule 1.1, I pointed out that, well, you really don't learn anything that you didn't already know, because all Rule 1.1 says is that you're supposed to be competent as an attorney. That who knows what that is? That's kind of hard to define.
Right.
So anyway, we got through Rule 1.0 and 1.1, and we are just starting. In fact, right before you joined in, I said that the next rule we're going to cover is the most important rule. So that was a perfect time to join in.
Great.
And I'll also point
I'll
also point out that a couple of points during the program, I'll be giving a code number. As a live caller, don't have to write it down or anything. I'm recording today's program for purposes of a future podcast. Podcast listeners will have that code number. So,
wonderful.
So anyway,
thank you for that clarification.
Okay. All right. So anyway, well, welcome as we join it in progress and we look at the most important rule, namely Rule 1.2. And the reason why I call this the most important rule is because it kind of defines it's our job description. Rule 1.2 tells us what lawyers do. What do we do for a living? So if anybody asks you what you do for a living, well, you point to Rule 1.2 and say, I do this. And also, Rule 1.2 is referred back to in many other rules. So to decide whether or not you've met your obligation under some other rule, you might have to turn to Rule 1.2 to assess that. So that's why I like to call it the most important rule, because it's our job description. We thought the practice of law was going to be a glamorous profession, but unfortunately our job description as contained in Rule 1.2 is not very glamorous, because what it says here is what do lawyers do for a living? Well, a lawyer shall abide by a client's decisions, period. Now, there's actually not a period there. There's a comma because it goes on to talk about something else. But I like to put that period just to stress the fact that that's kind of an absolute rule. You always have to abide by your client's decisions, no matter what. Well, not no matter what, because there are many, many exceptions to it. But basically, the burden of proof will be on you to show that the case fit into one of those exceptions. Because the general rule is what we do as lawyers, we do what our clients tell us to do. We shall abide by our clients' decisions. So when anybody asks, well, what exactly does a lawyer do? Say, we follow orders. We do exactly what our clients tell us to do. And that's kind of the default. Like I say, there will be many exceptions to that. But the general rule is you always have to abide by the client's decisions. And we'll cover many of those exceptions. We'll talk about some of them just in a minute here. And the rules are full of exceptions to that rule. But anytime one of those exceptions applies, pretty much it's going to be the burden of proof will be on you to show that that exception applies. Let's see. I heard some kind of a chime there.
Apologies, I got disconnected.
Oh, okay. Okay, I see. Yeah, I see the same number there. Actually, I should, and since we have such a small group today for our live callers, if you do have any questions, feel free to chime in at any point. I should, but you can email questions also, and I'm just checking my email here. Incidentally, podcast listeners, if you do have any questions or comments, feel free to email them to me at clem.law@usa.net or call me. 612-378-7751. I'm available for questions or comments after the program. But like I say, what do lawyers do for a living? We abide by our clients' decisions. Period. Now, the reason why there's a comma there is because they tell the corollary to that rule. Because it says, we shall abide by our client's decisions, but our representation doesn't constitute an endorsement of the client's political, economic, social, or moral views or activities. So in other words, our job is to do what our clients tell us to do. By doing those things, we're not endorsing what our clients tell us to do. We're simply doing our job. We are simply following orders. And this rule is the reason why I can say, you know, when people discover that I'm an attorney, sometimes they want to sound really intellectual and they want to engage in a deep ethical discussion. So they will ask a question like, "Well, would you represent a guilty person?" And they think that question is going to cause a lot of soul searching. But I kind of blow that question off pretty easily and say, well, of course I would represent the guilty person because the guilty person needs the attorney much more than the innocent person does. But this rule is why I can say that is because if my criminal defendant client wants to plead not guilty, despite the fact that he really is guilty, well, that's the client's decision. I mean, that's, you know, there's no decision more important than that. That's, you know, kind of the quintessential question that's entrusted to the client. Are you going to plead guilty or not guilty? By assisting him in that process of pleading not guilty, I'm not endorsing his criminal activities. I'm simply doing my job, abiding by my client's decision. Now, you know, I probably, remember Rule 1.1 says I'm supposed to be competent. So, the competent attorney will probably sit down with them and say, well, you know, there's overwhelming evidence of guilt. You know, you should probably take the plea bargain that they offered. But ultimately, that's the client's decision. And I shall abide by that client's decision, and therefore I'm not endorsing their criminal activities. I'm simply doing my job. You shall abide by your client's decision. So, like I say, that I think is the most important rule because that kind of defines what we do for a living. And like I say, other rules, when you're trying to decide whether or not an attorney has met their obligations under some other rule, you turn back to this one as kind of the main factor to consider in whether or not you've met that other rule. Now, like I say, there are exceptions to that, abiding by the client's decisions, and one of them is right here. And this is pretty easy. You knew this. You didn't need to go to a CLE to learn this. That you're not supposed to help your client commit crimes. Specifically, the rule says you shall not assist the client in conduct that you know is criminal or fraudulent. So obviously, you can take your guilty client to court and have him plead not guilty, but you can't you can't help him with his next crime. The client asks, well, can you drive the getaway car from my bank robbery? Well, obviously you can't do that because then you're assisting in conduct that you know is criminal or fraudulent. Or can you prepare the forgery, something? Obviously you can't do that. And you knew that. So that's easy. Where it gets a little bit more difficult, though, is the exception to that exception. Because even though you're not allowed to help the client commit a criminal activity, what you are allowed to do, and really what you're required to do, because it's the client's decision, you may discuss the legal consequences of any proposed course of conduct to help the client make a good faith effort to determine the scope, meaning, or application of the law. So what are they talking about there? I think a good example of that would be, your criminal case is pending. You're representing the defendant, and trial is going to start tomorrow morning. And your case isn't looking all that good. It looks like your client is probably going to get convicted, but he's still out on bail right now. So he calls up and asks, "Does the United States have an extradition treaty with Venezuela?" Are you allowed to answer that question? Because you go to the library, find the treaty, and it turns out, well, yeah, there is a treaty, but right now there's no the embassy is not functioning, and that treaty is kind of a dead letter at this point. So, in other words, what are the consequences if you or a guy flies to Venezuela? The consequences of that proposed course of action are that he's going to not face trial. He's going to escape the jurisdiction. But also, there's a criminal statute saying that it's against the law to flee the jurisdiction to avoid criminal prosecution. So that's a separate crime. So if you assist your client in going to Venezuela, that obviously is you're assisting in conduct that you know is criminal, and that's not permitted. But can you give that information? And I think the answer is clearly yes, because you may discuss the legal consequences of the proposed course of conduct. So you tell your client, well, if you do what you're proposing, namely going to Venezuela, the legal consequences of that are that you will escape prosecution. Now you have to tell them all the consequences. Things aren't so good there. You probably better bring your own food if you go there right now. And also the diplomatic situation will probably change at some point, and you will get extradited. So you have to, as a competent lawyer, you have to give them all the information. But I think that's pretty clear that you can give that information. Now, the prosecutor, when you show up for trial tomorrow morning and the judge asks, so, where's the defendant? You say, well, I think he might be in Venezuela. The prosecutor is probably not going to look on it quite as charitably as I did. And specifically, I think what you're going to find is that after having that conversation with your client, if you as much as lift a finger to help your client, then I think you're going to be in big trouble. Certainly if you have that conversation with the client and then your client says, well, great, can you give me a ride to the airport? Well, you have to say no to that. But on the other hand, if after having that conversation you give your client a glass of water, it could be argued that, that glass of water was the one thing that gave him enough energy to make it to the airport and escape the jurisdiction. So you want to be really careful in that situation, and that's one of those cases where I would definitely seek some outside counsel anytime something like that comes up. In fact, in Minnesota, you know, like I say, and probably Wisconsin and Iowa, one opportunity that you have is to call the regulator. So in my case, I can call the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility. And I think in that case, I would, and call them up and say, hey, you know, I got this phone call. The client wants to know about this extradition treaty. You know, I'm not going to do anything to help him, but I'm afraid that, you know, he might flee the jurisdiction. What should I do? And like I say, as long as I follow their advice, I'm pretty well protected. So like I say, hopefully, now if this rule comes up every day in the practice of law, maybe you should think about maybe finding a different class of clients, because hopefully it doesn't come up too often. Although these things do come up occasionally, so you want to have given them some forethought. Rule 1.2 talks about a couple of other points. It talks about limiting the scope of the representation. Obviously you can do that. It has to be reasonable, and the client has to give informed consent, and that consent has to be confirmed in writing. Almost always has to be confirmed in writing. There might be an exception if it was just a phone call or something. The reason why you have to kind of watch out for that rule is because, well, pretty much any time that you're representing somebody, you're limiting the scope of the representation. You know, sometimes it might be very explicit. You know, they might say, well, I have this, you know, they walk into the door with two documents. One is a criminal complaint and one is a civil complaint. And you tell them, well, I only represent attorneys or people on civil matters, so you'll have to take your criminal case elsewhere. That's obviously a very explicit limiting the scope of representation. But, you know, when you think about it, any time a client retains you, you're limiting the scope of representation to a certain extent because you're representing them for that one thing. You're not representing them for other things. You're not representing them for all of their legal needs for the rest of their life. So where do you draw the line to say that, you know, there's a limitation of representation? Well, it might be kind of hard to define. So I guess I would err on the side of caution and always have the client consent. You're not saying, you know, do you consent to me limiting representation to this matter? But, you know, have it specified pretty clearly. I'm representing you for drafting your will. And then it's clear that, you know, later on when they, you know, they have some property dispute that you're not representing them in that because, you know, they limited it to this one thing. But the real thing to watch out for is that that consent has to be confirmed in writing normally. So there's no rule that says all retainer agreements have to be in writing. There's not a rule that says that, but this rule kind of implies that because there's almost always some kind of a limitation on the scope of the representation. So that's something you want to watch out for. At this point, we've been going here for a while, so I'm going to give our first code number for our podcast listeners. The first code number is A16. A as in alpha 1-6. A16 is the first code number for this part of the program. So anyway, limitations on the scope of the representation. There should be some kind of writing generated. It doesn't have to be signed by the client. It can be a letter or even an email from you. But it's probably a good idea to kind of memorialize, have some kind of writing saying what the scope of representation is because of this rule and another rule that we'll talk about in a few minutes. One kind of interesting thing that comes up occasionally as far as I know, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa do not have a clear-cut rule on this. So what about the situation? Can I limit the representation to drafting a document for a pro se litigant to use in court? I certainly don't see why not. And I do that occasionally. Some client will come to me, and it's not something where I can formally represent them, but I want to, you know, help them out. I will draft the answer for them, or, you know, draft some document that they will file with the court. Doesn't happen too often, but it happens occasionally. I think that's perfectly okay. I'm just limiting the scope of the representation. But the issue that comes up in some states, and I don't think Minnesota, Wisconsin, or Iowa have explicitly addressed this issue, is, well, am I somehow concealing my involvement in the case? Am I kind of am I misleading the court? Am I taking part in kind of a charade against the court by not disclosing that I'm the attorney who drafted these documents? Because the reasoning is, in some states that have looked at this and say, well, wait a minute, if you do that, you're misleading the court because they have this pro se litigant there, and they think this paper that's being handed to them is a pro se document, and lo and behold, it was actually drafted by an attorney. So you helped the client mislead the court in submitting that document. I think that argument is a little bit of a stretch, but it's pretty easy to avoid that argument. The reason why I quote the Nebraska rule here is that they have kind of provided a safe harbor in those situations. And it's kind of what I typically do in those situations as well. I will prepare all the documents for the client's signature, but then I will put down at the bottom of the document, you know, this document was drafted by, and put my name and address to clear up any misunderstandings that the court might have about the document without actually entering an appearance in the case. So unless there's a compelling reason not to, that's typically what I do. And that's required in Nebraska, not necessarily required in other states, but probably a good idea because, like I say, some states have taken the position that, that's kind of you're making this misleading document by doing that. Other courts have looked at it and said, no, of course not, because that's kind of a ridiculous argument because the judge is going to figure it out. This pro se person here, and suddenly they get this document that, if you drafted it, hopefully it looks professional, they're going to figure out that some attorney probably prepared it, even though they don't know who that attorney was. So that you're misleading the court, that doesn't really hold a lot of water. And, the pro se litigant is really held to the same standards anyway, as somebody represented by an attorney. But like I say, it's probably a good idea to do that, to disclose your involvement, unless there's some compelling reason not to. So anyway, that's Rule 1.2. Like I say, the most important part of that is that you always have to do what your client tells you to do, and there are a few other subsidiary rules that go along with that. Rule 1.3, we're going to hit really fast because it just says, you're not supposed to procrastinate. You shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness in representing a client. Now, those of you who are taking this program live on November 25th, you are not procrastinators. You're definitely not, because you have over a month to finish your CLE. You're way ahead of the curve. You're probably in the top 1% of attorneys getting their CLE done on time, when I do this call on December 31st, it will be a different story. And a lot of attorneys are listening to this podcast on December 31st. So, first of all, Happy New Year. But also don't worry. This rule is not talking about that because all Rule 1.3 says is you shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness in representing a client. So putting your CLE off until December 31st, there's no problem with that. You're certainly not alone. There are a lot of other attorneys in the same situation. In fact, the reason why you put it off so long is because you've been so busy with your client matters. So it's actually a good thing. But don't procrastinate when it comes to your client matters, because number one, it's a violation of this rule. And also, as they say here in the comment, no professional shortcoming is more widely resented than procrastination. So the clients won't like it, and they will complain. So don't do it. So treat your client matters very expeditiously, even if it means putting your CLE off until the last minute. Be diligent. So lawyers procrastinate a lot. What do they procrastinate about? Probably the next rule, communication, especially communicating bad news. When attorneys have bad news to give their clients, there's a tendency to kind of delay. But unfortunately, the bad news doesn't get any better with age. So even if it's bad news, you want to communicate with your client because Rule 1.4 says that you have to. Your duty under Rule 1.4 is not particularly burdensome, though. There are a couple of specific things that you have to communicate. You have to communicate anytime there's consent involved. You know, you're saying, well, the client consented to this conflict of interest. Well, obviously, that consent has to be communicated at some point. If it's informed consent, you have to show that you communicated the information for them to make that informed consent. You have to, what's the other specific one here, number five? Oh, yeah, any relevant limitations on your conduct. If it's a jurisdictional kind of thing, if there's any kind of limitation on what you can do that's relevant to the case. So, you know, you have your Wisconsin attorney, the victim of a Minnesota car accident comes in. You know, it says, well, can you take my case? And they say, well, I can, but I can't actually represent you in Minnesota court. So that would be a relevant thing that you have to disclose. Or if there are time limitations that are relevant, you would have to disclose that. But those are the only specific things. Your general obligation to communicate is you have to tell the client how their objectives are going to be carried out. You know, say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to file this case and, get this order. And, you know, this is, you know, in general terms, you have to tell them how their objectives are going to be carried out. You have to keep them informed about the status of the case, and you have to comply with their reasonable requests for information. So it's, you just have to be reasonable. You have to communicate. And kind of the test is, well, again, Rule 1.2. Rule 1.2 says that the client makes all decisions. So the test of communication is, did you give them enough information so that they can intelligently make the decisions? And as long as you've done that, you've met your obligation. You don't have to go into excruciating detail about anything. However, this is one rule where you can err on the side of caution because even though you're not required to, tell everything in excruciating detail, you will never get in trouble if you over-communicate. So if you do tell them everything in excruciating detail, well, then you've clearly met your obligation. So this is one where I think I would, it's always best to err on the side of caution, because you'll never get in trouble for over-communicating, but you might get in trouble for under-communicating. I only had one attorney kind of take me to task with that statement, and she kind of had a point, and her point was... She was in family law or something. She originally early in her practice, she always went by my advice of communicating everything that happened. And then one day it occurred to her that she was stressing out her clients unnecessarily. Because when people get letters from lawyers, that's kind of a stressful thing. It turns out it's stressful even if it's your own attorney who's sending the letter. So she was causing this needless stress for her clients, and she discovered her clients weren't even opening the envelopes that she sent to them. So her reasoning was, well, I'm going to stop this over-communicating and just tell them in general terms how things are going to be carried out. And I guess she kind of had a point there. I can't totally disagree with her. But on the other hand, I think I would still err on the side of caution and communicate more than you need to. So anyway, Rule 1.4 says that we are supposed to communicate with our clients. Rule 1.5 talks about fees. And this is another one where Justice Stewart would probably define the term, because it says fees and expenses must not be unreasonable, but it doesn't define the word reasonable very much. We are given a little bit of a break as attorneys, because it doesn't say our fees have to be reasonable. Use the double negative. It says they can't be unreasonable. So I think that means that the burden of proof will not be on you to show that your fee was reasonable. Somebody else has to show that it was unreasonable. But in any event, your fees can't be unreasonable. But how do you define that? Well, not very well. But the rule lists a bunch of factors. The time and labor required, obviously, you know, that's how we get paid usually by the hour. The novelty and difficulty, whether the representation will prevent you from taking on other employment. So if you're full-time for one client, you'd probably get away with charging more than if you were, you know, just, you know, representing them occasionally. The customary charge in your area is a relevant factor. Not that you're supposed to engage in price fixing, but if the lawyer down the street is charging $1,000 and you're charging $10,000 for the exact same thing, well, that might be unreasonable. The amount involved and the results obtained, you can charge more for the big case where you're successful. Time limitations are relevant. The nature and length of your relationship with the client. So the long-term sophisticated client, you can probably charge more than the brand-new unsophisticated client. Your experience and reputation is an important factor, and whether the fee is fixed or contingent. We'll talk about contingent fees in a minute. So that's, you know, I don't know, what's that mean? What's an unreasonable fee? Well, you know, again, we'll know it when we see it. I've certainly never charged an unreasonable fee, so I'm in the clear on that one. But if I have ever violated a rule in my career as an attorney or come close to violating a rule, it's been Rule 1.5. Not because I charged an unreasonable fee. I'm not talking about that part of the rule, but the part of the rule that I've possibly violated is the next portion where it says, the fee and the scope of representation shall be communicated, preferably in writing. So again, how could I violate that rule? I'm not going to admit anything here, but you know, I probably come close to violating that rule. And the phone rings and somebody asks, you know, how much does it cost for you to do this for me? They ask for some service and I tell them a price. I say, well, I can do that for you. I'll charge you, $100. And, you know, that's the most reasonable fee in the world for drafting a deed or whatever. I'll do it for you for $100. Well, that's certainly a reasonable fee. So they say, oh, yeah, that's a reasonable fee. So I tell you, well, I'll just get to work on it right away because maybe I have all the information here. So I'll just mail you the deed when I'm done, and you pay me $100. That was certainly reasonable, but I probably violated this rule because I communicated the fee information, but I didn't do it in writing. So arguably I violated this rule. Now, I've never gotten disbarred for violating that rule. I've never been accused of it, actually. But if I were, I guess what I would say is I would kind of throw myself on the mercy of the court, and I say, but Your Honor, it doesn't say that I always have to communicate it in writing. It says I should preferably do it in writing. So maybe I'll get off on that technicality. But on the other hand, how do I answer the question when they say, okay, well, then why didn't you do it in this preferable manner? Well, why did you use this other method of doing it? And I don't really have an answer to that question. So that's something you have to watch out for. And again, Rule 1.2 says that you have to communicate any limitations in writing. These two rules read together kind of say that, you know, any time a client retains you, there probably should be some kind of writing in existence. It doesn't have to be from the client. It can be from you. Laying out, here's what I'm going to do for you. Here's how much I'm going to charge. Here's what I'm not going to do for you. Because these two rules kind of say that should be in writing. Now, those of you who are admitted in Wisconsin, Wisconsin has adopted a rule that's a little bit more suited to that situation, and I think kind of a reasonable rule, because in Wisconsin, If the reasonably foreseeable cost is going to be $1,000 or less, then it does not have to be in writing. Then it can be done orally. So that would that rule would save me in that situation when I get that phone call and I just quote a price over the phone. But that's not the rule in Minnesota. It's not the rule in Iowa. It's not the rule in most other states. Those of you in Wisconsin, it is. Now, that's a little bit of a double-edged sword for those of you in Wisconsin because there's such a black and white line there that you probably can't get away with making that argument that, that's preferable to do it that way. No, it's kind of an absolute thing. So if you give somebody a price of, I'll do that for you, it'll be $1,001, and you just communicate that orally, then you probably violated that rule. But again, the best practice is to kind of communicate everything in writing. Contingent fees. First of all, what is the definition of a contingent fee? A contingent fee is any time you make more money depending upon the outcome of the case. So anytime your fee is based upon what happens in the case, that's a contingent fee. Normally, when we say contingent fee, we think of the lawyer gets one-third and the client gets two-thirds. But it can be more broad than that. It can be any situation where you get more money depending on what happened in the case. And if it is a contingent fee, it's permitted, but there are certain requirements. There has to be a written contract, and it has to be a formal contract signed by the client, not just this, you following it up with a memo after the fact. It has to be a signed writing. And the rule tells specifically what has to be in that contract. So before you draft a contingent fee contract, be sure to read the actual text of the rule. Make sure that you have all of the contents in there. But as long as you do have that contract in place, written contract, a contingent fee is perfectly okay, with two exceptions. And those are family law cases and criminal cases. So you definitely can't say, I'll get one-third of the alimony in this divorce case, because that would be a contingent fee in a family law case. But remember, any time the outcome is going to be different. You can't say, I will only charge you if we get the restraining order or something. Well, that would probably be a contingent fee in a criminal or in a family law case. Similarly, in a criminal case, you can't have... the client gets 30 years and the lawyer gets 10 years. That would be prohibited. But you can't have, no fee unless you're acquitted. That probably wouldn't be a real smart business decision. But anytime you get more money, depending on what happens in the case. And the leading case on that actually comes from Wisconsin, where I believe in Madison, an attorney was advertising. He practiced in the area of drunk driving, so he advertised that he would win your case or you get a free bicycle. First of all, he probably gave away a lot of bicycles, but it was kind of a win-win situation. Your transportation needs are going to be taken care of one way or another, because either he wins the case and you get your driver's license back and everything is back to normal you can drive to work, or things don't go quite so well, at least now you have this new bicycle that you can get around with. So it's kind of a win-win situation. But the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that, because that is a contingent fee in a criminal case. Because if you lose the case, you're getting less money because you have to pay for the bicycle. So that's not permitted. But other than family law cases and criminal cases, contingent fees are allowed in pretty much anything else. The final topic covered by Rule 1.5 is fee splitting. Now, I'm going to pause here because... some of you who are not taking the full program, you won't be here when we get to Rule 7.2. So I'm going to give you an introduction to Rule 7.2. One of the things in Rule 7.2 says is that you can't pay a referral fee. You can't pay somebody to refer cases to you. It's just not allowed, period. There are no exceptions to it. You can't pay referral fees. You can't pay referral fees to attorneys. You can't pay referral fees to non-attorneys. It's just not allowed. If you're not going to be here for that hour, you just have to trust me. It's not allowed. But then when I say that, sometimes attorneys say, well, wait a minute. I thought it was okay to get a referral fee as long as you jump through the following hoops. And then he will list some hoops that are actually in this part of the rule. Well, the attorneys who point that out to me, they're not really wrong. To a certain extent, they are right, because if you get a referral fee and you jump through the right hoops, well, it's not really a violation of the rules, but it's a very sloppy use of language when you say that, because referral fee is prohibited, and the rule is very clear about it. There's something else that looks kind of similar to referral fee that is permitted, and that's the thing that's addressed here. And the thing that looks kind of similar to a referral fee is splitting the fee between more than one attorney who worked on the case. So in other words, if you and I are working together on a case, and I do half the work and you do half the work, well, it's certainly reasonable that you're going to get half the money and I'm going to get half the money. And so that's what this rule is talking about. And it doesn't fee splitting. Actually, here the states use a little bit different wording. Minnesota and Iowa say that it's okay as long as the fee is in proportion to the services provided by each lawyer. Wisconsin uses a different word. I think it's in relation. It has to bear a reasonable relationship to the services provided by each attorney. I don't think there's any practical difference, but I think the Wisconsin rule just wants to stress the fact that it doesn't have to be a mathematical certainty. You know, I did half the work, you did half the work, but what if one of us only gets one third of the fee? Well, that's still okay, because it's reasonable in relation to the amount of work we did. And that's true even if I referred the case to you. So I did, I did some of the work, you did some of the work, and I also referred it to you to be the lead counsel. It's okay for me to cash that check because I did work, and I'm getting paid in proportion to the services provided by each lawyer. Now, what I don't want you to do, though, when you send me that check, is if you write on the memo line referral fee. Well, no, you're not paying me for the referral, and I will tear up that check and I will not cash it, I can't get paid for the referral, but I can be paid for the work I did. So when those lawyers tell me that, is it okay to get a referral fee if I jump through the following hoops, namely do some work on the case, the answer is yes, kind of, but that's kind of like saying, murder is permitted in Wisconsin as long as you are acting in self-defense. Well, that statement is not, I guess it's kind of right, but you're kind of admitting guilt, too, because if it's self-defense, it's not murder anymore. Similarly, if you meet the requirements of fee splitting, it's no longer a referral fee. So it's okay as long as each lawyer provides services. Now, one of the first times I gave this program, I just moved on to the next thing after saying that, and then I got a frantic email from an attorney after the program saying, you left off some important words, and what I had left off was I did not include the words saying, it can be paid for services provided, or it's permissible under this rule for you to pay me for maintaining responsibility. So I referred the case to you, and I really didn't do very much work after sending it to you. Maybe I didn't do any work at all, but I maintained responsibility. Well, that's permissible. You can split the fee with me. But what can you, what are you paying me for, though? You're not paying me for referring the case to you. You're paying me for maintaining responsibility. And sure enough, that is what the rule says. And, you know, you're probably aware there are attorneys that do pay referral fees, and that's what they squeeze it into. But for heaven's sake, don't call it a referral fee if you do that, because, you know, referral fees are not permitted, at least not in Wisconsin, Minnesota, or Iowa. Interestingly, they are permitted in some states, including Michigan. Michigan has a similar set of rules, but they are permitted there. Okay? One Michigan attorney took the program, told me about that. So, but anyway, the... so watch out for that. Don't take referral fees, and if you do, certainly make sure that you call them by another name. Don't say, "Oh, this is great. I just, you know, buying my new yacht because of this referral fee that I received today." Well, no, don't say that. So anyway, that's all the rules talking about fees are contained in Rule 1.5. Rule 1.6. Talks about confidentiality. Now, a couple of things to point out. First of all, we're not talking about the attorney-client privilege here. The attorney-client privilege is kind of outside of the scope of today's program. And the attorney-client privilege is actually pretty narrow because what the attorney-client privilege is that under certain situations, under pretty limited circumstances actually, subject to many exceptions, if a client tells you something, you can never be compelled to say what your client told you. So my client comes in and tells me all kinds of interesting information, and then the next day I get a subpoena to appear in front of the grand jury. And, you know, I'm called in there, and the prosecutor asks, you know, "What did your client say to you yesterday?" Well, the correct answer to that question is I refuse to answer because of the attorney-client privilege, and they can't even send me to jail for refusing to answer because that's privileged. Now, as a practical matter, I might go to jail because there are so many exceptions to that rule, but that's what the attorney-client privilege is. Well, I don't know about you, but that's never happened to me, that hypothetical that I just gave. So in other words, it's safe to say that in all my years of practice of law, I have never once had to deal with the attorney-client privilege. It has never come up. Now, you know, I'm sure it's come up, you know, probably in some indirect fashion or whatever, but it's really kind of a non-issue. It's not something we have to worry about. Well, you know, it doesn't come up very often. On the other hand, Rule 1.6 here comes up all the time. Every day you need to, every day Rule 1.6 applies to you. Because what Rule 1.6 says, and Rule 1.6 is extremely broad, because it says you shall never reveal information relating to the representation of a client. Now there are some exceptions to that, but that's the general rule. You can never share information that you know because you were representing a client. Not necessarily confidential information, even stuff that, you know, is in the, you know, kind of the public domain. Because the rule says that if you learned it in the course of representing a client, well, then it's confidential. You shall never disclose that information to anybody unless you can fit it under one of these exceptions. So in other words, everything you do in the practice of law, you know, whenever you're at work, well, whatever you're doing is confidential. And if you ever say anything about what you do for a living, which obviously you're going to do very often, but you have to, the burden of proof will be on you to show that it's a proper disclosure. Because the general rule is that it's confidential. There are exceptions. First of all, consent. Obviously, the client can consent to that. But the biggest exception is, well, unless it was, you had to reveal it because that you had to do your job. disclosures that are impliedly authorized in order to carry out the representation. So in other words, if it was necessary for the representation, because what do we do as attorneys? Well, you know, basically, we communicate on, you know, we're a mouthpiece, as they say. You know, we're communicating on behalf of our clients, so we're disclosing information all the time. That's why the client hired us, because they want us to, you know, they were injured and they want us to disclose that information to the insurance company so that they can get their money. You know, that's what we're retained to do. So obviously that disclosure is impliedly authorized in order to carry out the representation. So in other words, what the rule really says is never reveal information unless it's necessary to do your job. And because it's worded that way, again, the burden of proof will be on you. So if you'll have to. So anytime you communicate on, you know, information that relates to a client, you have to have in the back of your mind, you know, I might have to justify this. I might have to say, you know, why it was necessary to disclose this information, because everything by default is confidential. Now there are many exceptions to that. The first one is stated right here, and the because we're kind of limited on time, I won't spend a lot of time on this, although, because hopefully this doesn't come up too often, this next exception is, well, what if you discover that your client is about to commit a crime? Well, if you discover that, then there might be an exception, but you have to read the exception carefully. And it also varies a little bit from state to state. And for reasons that will become apparent in a minute, we are going to stop talking about Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa law, and for just a moment, we're going to pretend that we are Nebraska attorneys. So we are sitting in our Omaha office, and we discover that our client is about to commit a crime. So we pull out our Nebraska rules of court, and the rule says that, there's an exception. We may reveal information if we think it's necessary to keep the client from committing a crime. This clearly applies. So your Nebraska client tells you that they're about to commit this, they're about to go murder somebody. So the rule says that you may pick up the phone and call 911, call the Omaha Police Department, and disclose the fact that your client is about to commit a murder. That is permissible. You are allowed to do that. On the other hand, it's late in the day, maybe it's a Friday afternoon when you learn this information. You don't want to get involved in this police matter. You know, if you call the cops, they'll be asking all kinds of difficult questions. So you decide, you know what, life is too short to worry about this. So you just go home, and your client goes and murders somebody. You complied with the rules, because it didn't say you had to call 911. It just said you were permitted to call 911 if you felt like it. Well, those of us in other states we have a little bit of righteous indignation when we hear about these shysters down in Nebraska doing that sort of thing. So we think to ourselves, you know, that would never happen here in Minnesota or Wisconsin or Iowa. So we need to toughen the rule a little bit. So therefore, in those states, in Minnesota and Wisconsin, they changed the text of the rule to say that a lawyer shall reveal the information. So in that hypothetical, that no longer was in our Omaha office, that was taking place in our Madison office. We are required to pick up the phone and call the police, because we think revealing that information is necessary to keep the client from committing a serious crime, namely a crime that will result in death or serious bodily injury or a substantial financial loss. So we can pat ourselves in the back up here, because we're a lot more ethical than these Nebraska attorneys. Well, I guess so, but there is a certain practical value to the Nebraska rule, and I think the Nebraska rule actually makes a little bit more sense. And also, I've met a lot of these Nebraska attorneys, and I'm sure they would do the right thing in that situation. The problem with the rule is not when you have a major crime, or not when you have a a minor crime, but when you have something kind of in between. Because let's take the example of a minor crime first. Let's say that your client comes in and they tell you, you know what, I'm a kleptomaniac, and I'm going to go down to Walmart and do some shoplifting of a package of gum. Well, what are you supposed to do in that situation? Well, you should probably try to talk your client out of it. But, you know, if they leave and, you know, you discover they're going to commit this crime, well, it's not a serious crime. It's not. There's no death involved. There's no serious bodily injury. It's not even a substantial amount of money. So your obligation in any state in that situation is, well, the information is confidential. You can't call up 911 and turn in your shoplifting client. But what about in those in that middle ground? You know, what if your client is going to go down and steal the, you know, the big screen TV for $1,000? You know, is that a substantial amount of money? Well, I don't know. So in that situation, I would tell the Nebraska attorney to err on the side of caution, and namely not disclose the information because. Well, you're safe in Nebraska. It's a safe harbor if you do not disclose the information because you're only permitted to reveal it. You're never required to. But in Minnesota, Wisconsin, well, you kind of a difficult situation there because if it's a substantial amount of money, you're required to disclose it. If it's a small amount of money, you're not you get in trouble if you do disclose it. So I guess in that situation, I would call the ethics hotline and ask them what they think you should do to get some protection. Of course, try to talk the client out of it first. So even though it makes us feel better up here in the colder states, there's some wisdom to the Nebraska approach. Now Iowa kind of takes some middle ground, if that's possible. As a practical matter, I think their rule is identical to the Minnesota rule, because Iowa still uses the word may, but then it goes on to say that they shall do it if the harm is imminent. I don't think that really makes any difference because it's a little bit different wording anyway, so you can tell at least they grappled with it a little bit. Okay, other exceptions to confidentiality. You can reveal client confidences in certain disputes with clients. So if a client is suing you or you are suing the client for your bill or something, and if it's necessary to disclose information, you can do that. You can comply with the court order. So if the court tells you that you have to disclose the information, complying with that court order will not get you in trouble under these rules. Although, again, the competent attorney might decide, well, do I need to appeal that order? If you want to know what you need to do, if you're seeking legal advice from another attorney, you can disclose information there. Possibly you can disclose some information to determine whether or not a conflict of interest exists. So that brings us up to the end of Rule 1.6. And at this point, I'm going to give the second code word, and that is B42. B42 is the second code word. At this point, we're going to have a brief pause here, and we will continue this with the podcast here in a few minutes.